Good afternoon. I think I have been to Toronto two or three times before, but not in the last 15 years. And the place seems to be quite changed. Different people, different sets of characters. I'm going to tell you an amusing story from the point of view of physics, but also from the point of view of the lack of communication among condensed matter theorists and particle theorists, leading to interesting nomenclatural differences when they are working on similar problems, and interesting sets of misunderstandings. The work that I'm going to talk about is very old. It was done around 1981, and it was spurred by some Raman scattering experiments done at Urbana by Klein and his group. And then there were some remarks made about this work in the mid-80s by Nambu, saying that what we were calling the amplitude mode of superconductor was really the Higgs, and I thought Nambu was joking in a Eastern fashion, a different Eastern fashion tradition than mine. But then in the mid-90s, there was a book saying, oh, the Higgs has been discovered in superconductors. And at that point, I had to start learning what Higgs meant in particle physics. And this second paper here was really an attempt to understand it. The biggest and most amusing issue here is going to be that it is completely obvious that all superconductors have Higgs bosons, what are called Higgs bosons. However, 1980s, everything about superconductivity was understood and discovered, and this was not mentioned. And that's an amusing story in itself that I'll tell you a little bit about. Finally, the resurgence of interest in this is due to these happenings at CERN. And also, there are some new experiments in Paris which address an important point which was suggested in the 1980s but not really tested in the experiments by Klein. Incidentally, may I ask if there are any high-energy physicists, how many high-energy physicists or whatever they're called these days, string theorists and whatnot, are here? Okay, fair number. Okay, good. So, excuse me? It makes the cross-cultural exchange a little more interesting. You will see that I'm a great admirer of what is being done at CERN in high-energy physics and the models that led to it. Okay, so as I said, this thing was spurred by some experiments, Raman scattering experiments done on a compound called niobium diselenide. And a Raman scattering experiment consists of taking a sample and shining on it light at some polarization with the directions defined with respect to the crystalline axis at an energy omega incident, and out comes a photon in general in a different polarization, E out, and a different frequency, which means that you have left behind in the crystal an excitation which has to be characterized by a second rank tensor and with an energy difference, omega in minus omega O. And this experiment was one of the first Raman scattering experiments done on metals. Miles Klein initiated this technique. There are a variety of reasons why in metals this is a particularly hard technique. And in niobium diselenide, which has a superconducting transition temperature of 7.2 Kelvin, they discovered a sharp mode which appears at 2 Kelvin and does not appear above. And the experiment was only done at 2 Kelvin and not continuously as a function of temperature, which was a paucity of the Raman scattering technique of those days. You could not do it at higher temperature. If there are graduate students here, especially experimentalists, please think why it would be hard to do an experiment above superfluid helium temperature, which was being used to cool. But now these experiments are possible. And there's this mode whose energy was quite close to the known twice superconductive gap of niobium diselenide, both in one particular symmetry, A1G, which is a breathing mode. Poof, it's just the simplest mode, and a more complicated mode which showed exactly the same thing. That in itself should be a big surprise, because you had same mode appearing in completely orthogonal symmetries. And I'm going to tell you that these are the Higgs modes, which are present in all superconductors, but are very hard to detect, and a fortunate set of circumstances led to their detection in niobium diselenide. So I'm going to tell you my version of the basics of superconductivity from the point of view of Ginzburg-Landau theory, which is the theory on which Higgs had based his calculation in 1964. He was really doing the simplest gauge theory, not to do with weak interactions, were not understood at that time. So what really brought this into real physics, in high energy physics, was a paper 4 or 5 years later by Weinberg. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the gauge invariance in BCS and phase modes, and then talk about the amplitude modes, or the Higgs, and with apologies to lots of people here who know a hell of a lot more of this than I do, I'm going to tell you, if I have time, the relationship of this to the standard model of particle physics, and lead to this question, which is at the heart of detecting it in condensed matter physics: how does one couple to the Higgs, and why it is so hard? And then I'm going to talk to you about more experiments. And finally, this I've given this talk many times, and this turns out, if there are high-energy physicists in the audience, the most amusing part of the talk, I hope I get to it, which is when a condensed matter theorist begins studying standard model, the kinds of experiments done at LHC, the kinds of questions that occur to him. I have answers to most of these by now, but it's amusing to repeat the questions. So, how did we begin to understand superconductivity? Superconductivity began to be understood, like all good things, following a good experiment. And the good experiment was the Meissner-Oxenfeld effect, that magnetic field does not penetrate superconductors, okay, which is the heart of the matter of superconductivity. And its explanation, phenomenological explanation by London and by Ginzburg-Landau. But let me say that the heart of the matter is that superconductivity is a macroscopic coherent quantum state in which the metallic electrons develop a stiffness. Superconductivity is not something where something goes flabby. It's something where something goes stiff. Let me illustrate what I understand by stiffness. You see this object? If I push it from one corner, See, I push it from one corner, all of it moves. You do that every day. It does not happen in a gas or a liquid. This is a very remarkable phenomenon. The mathematical description of this is in fact harder than the stiffness in superconductivity. Okay? And the stiffness takes, in this case, the form that you cannot move an electron, you have to move all of them, which follows from the magnetic field being zero inside the superconductor. This is different from a perfect conductor. And here is one of the peculiarities that come in. In a perfect conductor, you cannot change the magnetic field. Okay? If it's zero, it stays zero. If you apply a field, if it was finite, it stays finite. In a superconductor, it is zero. Okay? And this is a peculiar property which arises from whether you do an experiment at long wavelength and then let the frequency go to zero, or you let the frequency go to zero first and then go to long wavelength. Meissner effect is done in the second limit. So this has always puzzled me when my particle theorists talk to us about the condensate, which is us, everything around us is a condensate, the electroweak condensate, because they have a Lorentz invariant theory. So I've never understood how they take these two limits. You cannot take these two limits differently in a Lorentz invariant theory. So if somebody will enlighten me on this point, it would be nice. Okay, so Ginsberg and Landau, after London, said, oh, this has to be some macroscopic phenomena, macroscopic quantum phenomena. And if it's a quantum phenomena, you have to describe it by a wave function. And this wave function has to ultimately carry current, so it has to be a complex wave function. It has to have a phase phi and an amplitude psi of r. And then just from the invariance condition, you have mod psi square and mod psi fourth. If you apply a gradient, if you vary this superconducting wave function, you have to do it in a gauge invariant fashion. And when you calculate the current, apart from the vector potential, you have to take the gradient of the phase. It comes from this term, type mod psi square. Okay. And given this, the London equation, the Maxwell's equation, which says that curl of B is related to the currents, you can get out this equation, which says that the magnetic field will not penetrate. So given a macroscopic wave function, which has some stiffness associated with it, you will get the magnetic field not penetrating, and there'll be a length scale, or what high-energy physicists would call a mass scale, and this is really the mass of their W boson, is really what we in condensed matter physics call the London penetration length. Okay? So let's look at this Hamiltonian, or the energy corresponding to this. And let's for a moment forget about any gradients. And so here we have a simple theory, mod psi square plus mod psi fourth. And let's say we are below the phase transition, so R is negative. So for a given fixed phase, the energy will have a maxima with the wrong curvature at psi equal to zero, and then minima somewhere else, and you will select the bottom as the vacuum state, mod psi, non-zero. But you notice that there was this phi variable, and in this picture, where there are no gradients, where I'm drawing the energy as a function of two coordinates, modulus of psi and phi, the energy does not depend upon phase. You can pick any phase you like as long as you're doing it uniformly. And what that really means is that if you can pick any phase, you can go from one phase to the other slowly, and as you go slowly enough, it'll cost you less and less energy. And that is the statement of the Goldstone theorem, that if you have a complex order parameter in this case, and you have a broken symmetry, there will be a collective mode whose energy will go to zero in the long wavelength limit. This was a big headache in the 60s for particle theorists. They wanted to make gauge theories for some reason, but they didn't have any low energy fluctuations. Okay, and this issue was really resolved by Weinberg following Higgs. Okay, so now that is this object. But then you look here, you might think that you could oscillate the magnitude of psi, magnitude. And that's the mode I'm going to talk about. And as I said, Littlewood and I called it the amplitude mode. And the same model was used to calculate various properties of superconductors. Everything about superconductivity was understood. But it did not give this Higgs particle to condensed matter theorists, okay? But it did to Higgs based on the same Lagrangian. Okay? That's an amusing story. Also, there is no Higgs in superfluid helium 4, which formally is a similar theory. Okay? So that's the sort of thing I'm going to try to explain. So let me go back to this business of the phase mode for a moment and try to clarify the difference between Higgs field, the Higgs boson, and the W boson, or the Goldstone mode. Okay, Goldstone mode. And there's a lot of confusion, especially among condensed matter theorists, or there used to be, less and less so now, because you see, I came of age in Bell Labs, and we grew up thinking that everything that had to be discovered in particle physics and condensed matter physics had already been discovered by my mentor, Anderson. Okay? And that arose from a confusion between the Higgs mode and the Goldstone mode, okay, that issue. I can tell you very many amusing stories about that. Okay, so if you look at your Hamiltonian, it has some invariance, okay? And I have done a wretched thing here. I'm going to describe the problem, this problem, in terms of some coordinate around which I'm going to measure the amplitude. I will call it tau 1. I'm going to call orthogonal to it this phase phi. If vary, that's going to be along coordinate phi. And then I'm going to call something along the charge sector, okay, tau 3. And these things make good orthogonal coordinates, okay, in a quantum mechanical sense. So given that, I can rotate the, this should be psi, I can rotate, ultimately what do I want? I want continuity equation to be obeyed. Derivative of density with respect to time should be divergence of the current, or minus the divergence of the current. So that is a statement of local gauge invariance, fancy phrase, that you can change the, you can rotate in the tau 3 direction, around the tau 3 direction, and you know that this current is going to be related to the phase, and this is related to the density of particles, so this has to be satisfied. Now, the funny thing was that the way BCS solved the superconductivity problem, they did not satisfy this. They got everything right that they calculated, but they were clever enough not to calculate anything which, actually, they calculated thing in a particular gauge and got everything right, and that's the only gauge in which they could have gotten things right. And if they had calculated in any other gauge, they would have gotten nonsense, okay? So if you're BCS, you not only have to be smart, you have to be super smart, and super smart means lucky, okay? So you have to do a somewhat better calculation. So when BCS theory came out, this is before even my time, I heard stories about lots of theorists jumping around saying, this theory has to be nonsense because it doesn't satisfy gauge invariance. And there were people who said, my God, it explains almost 100 years of experiments, and if there is a lacuna in the theory, somebody will fix it, okay? And there are a number of people who fixed it. The Russians never thought it was a problem because immediately, within 6 months of the appearance of BCS theory, Gorkov derived the Ginzburg-Landau phenomenological theory from it, and Ginzburg-Landau theory is manifestly gauge invariant. So they never had a emotional problem with it. There was a big emotional problem in Western Europe and in this country. Okay, so. Talking of Landau, I thought I would take a little hiatus and show you. This is a painting done by Lev Gorkov. We didn't know that Lev was an artist. Lev is the guy who, at age 25, derived Ginzburg-Landau from BCS theory. And in 1961, this painting is. It's dated 1961, and this is Landau staring at a famous diagram in quantum electrodynamics while there are all kinds of things going on around him. Landau was an interesting man, but I'm always amazed, sort of 1960s Soviet Union, Lev Gorkov doing things like this. And this is what Lev Gorkov looks like these days. That is 2010. That was his 75th birthday. Okay. So let's go back to this. And the important point is that what we see here is condensed matter physics is very easy, right? We know our Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is always related to things happening in the charge sector. So here is the kinetic energy, and here is a density-density interaction with some general potential, okay? That's all. Now, what BCS did was to say, we want to discover something new and amusing, so they kept this term, but they said, instead of this, we will write it as an object along the Tauan channel. So Tauan channel would mean psi dagger, and psi, okay? So that object. And then, of course, you have forgotten lots of things here, and you do mean field theory, and you determine this parameter delta of k. From my point of view, the important thing that you have to bear in mind is that this Hamiltonian or equivalent Lagrangian bears exact one-to-one correspondence with the Dirac equation for fermions, okay? That's going to be important. So first question was, making the BCS theory gauge invariant, and Anderson and others did it, and they obtained this Goldstone mode, whose physics I have told you, but all these people were smart enough to realize that you're talking about motion of charge, and charges interact with Coulomb interactions, which in the longitudinal channel leads to plasmons in an ordinary metal. Okay? Plasmons are primarily responsible, or to a large extent responsible, for the color of materials. Now, you would not think that, I mean, if that mode became go to zero frequency, the color of everything would change because of superconductivity, which is manifest nonsense, because color is determined by plasmons with 2 volt or 4 volt or 10 volt energy. And clearly, these phase modes have to couple with Coulomb interaction. And it turns out they go back to the plasma frequency with a tiny correction. Okay, so this is your Anderson mechanism for getting the W boson. And Higgs in his paper starts off from this Anderson calculation. So as I said, this determines in Higgs kind of theory the range of weak interactions, although. So what's a plasmon? It's the dumbest thing, right? It's the simplest thing in the world. You have n protons and n electrons, charged system, and supposing you move these electrons on one side, leaving positive charges, start with that initial condition, it starts sloshing back and forth. Because of the long-range nature of the Coulomb interaction at precisely the plasma frequency. So the W boson is nothing else but the plasmon. Okay? And the whole issue of the gauge invariance and whatnot was very neatly settled by these calculations by Anderson and Nambu and Gorkov. Now, but so far we have not talked about the amplitude mode. Now, in 1981, I discovered a paper by Nambu, which I may have even understood, where he was trying to do BCS theory, and he pointed out that besides that gauge invariance, which comes from this unitary transformation, psi going to e to the I alpha of r and t tau 3, there are some non-unitary transformations that the solid-state Hamiltonian obeys. And we have to make a theory consistent with that, and you can make a theory consistent with that, and you will find then a mode in the tau 1 sector. Now, the important part is there are two important points. The moment you make a theory in the tau 1 sector consistent with some equation which is obeys this invariance, you'll get a collective mode. See, we did not know about Ginzburg-Landau for particles for condensed matter physics has been done for years and years, and no amplitude mode was discovered. But there was this experiment of Miles Klein seeing something new. And we didn't understand why Ginzburg-Landau wasn't giving it. So we said, let's do microscopic theory and see what happens, okay? Which was a stupid thing to do because one has to work much harder. If the answers could have been obtained if we understood anything, much easier. Anyway, if you do this, there'll be a mode in the tau 1 sector. And the important thing to realize was that the tau 1 sector is not a charged sector in condensed matter physics sense, and therefore does not couple to Coulomb interactions. Therefore, whatever we get would be the collective mode. And when that was done, we found that there was a collective mode precisely at 2 delta. In fact, there was more. The appearance of this mode was a necessary condition for the existence of superconductivity, okay? And this nu equal to 2 delta is the weak coupling result, weak coupling superconductivity result. The moment you have superconducting condensation, there has to be all superconductors, all theories of this kind have to have Higgs. But when you got something like that, this does not help at all with the observed sharp mode, because this mode has no charge, no dipole moment, no magnetic moment, and we couple with external probes to these things. Okay, so how would you ever discover it? Okay? This is also the reason why in LHC, Higgs is much harder to discover. Okay? Even in the most favorable circumstances here, when you scatter 10 to the 3 photons in niobium diselenide, you get one photon Raman scattered to give you the Higgs. In LHC, at current running power, or the running power which stopped just now, it's a few months ago, you have to scatter 10 to the 10 times to get one Higgs. Okay? And it'll get better to 10 to the 9 with the next upgrade. It'll happen in a year or two. Okay. So we had a mode, but we had no idea how you could see these things. And at that point, we had to ask this question, what the hell are these objects? Because what Miles Klein, et cetera, had observed was that these objects had diminished their intensity when this appeared. Okay? Now, these things were easy to understand because niobium diselenide has a what's called a charge density wave transition. Charge density wave transition is simply a structural transition in which the electrons participate. Okay? So when you have a structural transition and the crystal changes symmetry, so let's say there were 4 atoms per unit cell and now there are 6 atoms per unit cell or what have you. Now these fellows have to vibrate, and that means there should be additional modes at low at Q equal to 0 in the new crystal structure because you have changed symmetry. Okay? So what had happened was that in niobium diselenide, at temperatures about 33 K, these things were not present, and these things appeared below the charge density wave transition. The data was available only at 9 Kelvin, but they appeared. Okay? These were new modes, and you could expect from the group theory that you would indeed expect modes in this symmetry. And what do these modes do? Well, in effect, if you take a simple version of the Fermi surface, and this is the new Q vector, new periodicity introduced, around that direction, if I blow it up, the electrons develop a gap. This gap is developed proportional to the amplitude of this displacement, static displacement. But now I can take that static displacement and move it. That's the lattice vibration. And adiabatically, the electrons will move. And if the electrons move, I'm shaking the foundation on which superconductivity rests. I'm shaking the universe of superconductor, and I use that word very advisedly. And if I do that, we said there will exist a coupling where you have the displacement of the phonon, and displacement of the phonon must couple to the amplitude of the superconductor. Now look at this, okay? So what this, if it had an expectation value, would be delta. So G, we said, is V d delta du. The moment we say V d delta du, you see, this alone, if you look at it, this looks horrible. It's breaking all kinds of symmetries, right? How can you couple displacement to superconductivity, okay? Right? And this is going to be, I'm going to explain that. Okay, the only clever thing Littlewood and I did was to write this down. Okay, and now when that happens, you see, now you have a linear coupling of a displacement to something else. And if something else has a collective mode, you cannot excite you without exciting it. That's a property of linearly coupled things. And one more thing, if you had some spectral weight in this U, the oscillation of U had some spectral weight, this mode can only come by stealing that spectral weight. The total spectral weight must be conserved. This is a theorem, elementary theorem about linear couplings. Okay? So the tau 1 mode or amplitude mode must appear, talking fancy, as a pole in the self energy, and we calculated a few things, and if this was the phonon, it would then spill out some weight in a sharp fashion. Also, it would spill it out, if the coupling constant was large enough, it would spill it out below the continuum, slightly below 2 delta, and the damping from particle hole pairs would vanish. Okay? This is all to the good. There were some points of agreement with the experiment, but what was never fully tested was that the total spectral weight as a function of temperature must be conserved. This would distinguish it from any other kind of mode. Okay? So it was wonderful, therefore, that a group in Paris with the new technology that has come about in Raman scattering between 82 and 2012, 30 years, now you can do experiments continuously as a function of temperature. Previously, you had to shine enough light so that if helium was not superfluid, you would form, it would boil off, and if it would boil off, it would scatter photons like mad, and you could not do anything. Now you can work with 10,000 times smaller power and get signals. That's what I was told. The number is 10,000 power. And now you can do this experiment continuously as a function of temperature, and you see at 8 degrees you see this phonon, and you go below the superconducting transition temperature, you begin to develop this mode, and if you take this weight at any temperature, this function at any temperature, and subtract off the 8 degree spectra, you get something like this, and this weight is equal to this weight to within about 5%, which is the accuracy of the experiment. So you're saying, hey, it's conserved. But they did something more clever than this. There's another compound, niobium disulfide, which is also superconducting, but has no charge density wave transition. Okay? And they looked at it above the superconducting transition temperature and below the superconducting transition temperature, and this is what you see. There are two curves here, below and above. It's 7 Kelvin and 2 Kelvin, whereas niobium diselenide look like this. So no charge density wave phonon, nothing to reveal the Higgs or the amplitude mode. Okay? So this was proven by this very nice experiment. But why is it the Higgs? Well, it's the Higgs because Peter Higgs says so. Okay? So there was this article that I came across in a book after having ignored Nambu 10 years earlier, saying that, oh, this particular existence of characteristic massive spin zero mode had not. First, he's making sure people understand that Anderson did not have it, Angler and Brown did not have it, he had it, but the theory of what particle physicists would call the Higgs mode in superconductor was not published until 81, and that's this thing that Littlewood added. So the question comes, why was the theory not done earlier for superconductor? Okay? But before coming to that, let me come to this statement that I made. You have to shake the universe to get free of conservation laws, okay, to see the Higgs. Let me explain that. So I put down some coupling, lambda u d delta du, or this tau 1 object. So now a displacement in condensed matter physics or in any physics only couples to densities, real densities. That's how we can couple. So here is a real density. So it's a particle-hole pair. And I have to make a particle-particle pair out of it, okay, to couple this thing to this. How can I do it? I can do it by saying that there must exist a vertex of this kind where there is a superconducting pair here, but this object is condensed. I have a condensed mode. Okay, I have a vacuum expectation value of this object. Okay, therefore, I can simply say, oh, it just provides an amplitude, allowing me this peculiar, seemingly non-conserving mode. It's like saying, if this table is heavy enough, I cook it, kick it, I don't have to worry about conserving momentum. Okay, it's condensed. So here in this case, in other words, okay, so Higgs says the observation of this mode is a proof of the existence of a condensate. In condensed matter physics, that's no big deal. We have a few hundred other ways of proving that there's a condensate in superconductivity, okay? This thing is even more dramatic when recently they discover some modes under certain conditions in both superfluids and cold atoms. Again, what Mr. This guy in Germany, Bloch, does is to make some cold atoms, they are in a trap, and then he shakes the trap, and then he passes some radio frequencies and observes a threshold for absorption under certain conditions, which I may have time to talk about, which is supposed to be related to this amplitude mode. And there it's even more dramatic. With a displacement, you can only excite density of bosons, B dagger B. But in a superfluid, we have a condensation of this B, object B alone. So that's a vacuum expectation value. That's what it means to be a superfluid. and when you start with bosons, and therefore I have a direct coupling. Let me skip this. So I wondered how Higgs was being discovered at LHC, and everything that people were talking about was that, my God, here is some object which is a scalar, the psi or the Higgs mode, and if it's a scalar, I can couple it to any pair, phi bar phi, whatever, vector bosons, leptons, hadrons, I can couple to anything. And there's this thing, the Higgs gives mass to the particles. Well, this is the existence of this term is what they meant. But this thing, when you are probing decays from here, you're not relying on the existence of a condensate. And I had to go around to lots of high energy physicists who understood my question. Hey, we have detected in LHC the Higgs. Is that a proof that there is an electroweak condensate? And finally, Andy Cohn and David Gross explained to me one particular channel for the detection of the Higgs. And the problem is that these guys, they all draw diagrams like this. And you see, this is some vector boson. And there's the Higgs coming out. And this vertex explicitly assumes that there is a condensed state, okay? Otherwise, they would be again violating electroweak conservation laws. Okay, so this kind of process, which is one of the dominant channels through which LHC works, is indeed a proof of the existence of a condensate. It's amazing. We are all in a condensate, okay? I find that weird. Okay, so why was Higgs missed in condensed matter physics over all these years, okay? So it's a very simple thing. You have this Ginzburg-Landau-Lagrangian, and you take some expectation value, mod psi. Okay, R is negative, so this thing exists. And now all we need to do is to consider small oscillations about this object. So small oscillations can be change of the amplitude or having some phase. And now I can write down linearized equations of motion. But I am a condensed matter physicist, so I'm used to writing down first-order equations of motion in time. The Schrodinger equation, after all, is first-order equation in time. Okay? Or I am Ginzburg-Landau, and I'm very concerned about damping near the phase transition. After all, Ginzburg-Landau theory is supposed to be valid only very close to TC, where there is damping. So again, I write down linear term in the time derivative. So let me do the Schrodinger equation first. So if I do that, I will discover that there is no Higgs. I'll just get Bogoliubov mode, okay? And this is what was going on in condensed matter physics for all these years. What Mr. Higgs had done, being a particle theorist, he had constructed a Lorentz invariant theory. So if he had a second derivative in time, he had to have a second derivative. Second derivative in space, he had to have a second derivative in time. And immediately comes the Higgs. The point in relation to superconductivity is what I mentioned to you earlier, that although the metallic state is not particle hole symmetric, the superconducting state is to a very good approximation particle hole symmetric. You remember I said BCS Hamiltonian or Hamiltonians around BCS Hamiltonian all bear a one-to-one correspondence with Dirac equation. They're particle hole symmetric. If you have a particle hole symmetric theory, you must have second derivative in time because a hole is just an electron going backwards, so to speak. Okay? So that's the secret. So in a superconductor, near TC, you have damping, and so you do Ginzburg-Landau theory, no Higgs. You go to low temperature, the damping disappears, you have to have an equation which is particle hole symmetric, and you have to write down second order equations of motion and time. And when Littlewood and I did the theory, we did a microscopic theory consistent with that particle hole symmetry, and that's how out fell the in microscopic theory, the Higgs. Okay? I already said all this. So anything from superconductivity of interest to high energy physics. So first thing I have to say is that since there is a basic theory of metals and superconductors, the Higgs is not all that important in condensed matter physics. Okay? If we only had a phenomenological theory, Ginzburg-Landau, like the standard model is, standard model intellectually is a phenomenological theory at the level of the Ginzburg-Landau theory. If that's all we had, and somebody had discovered this sharp resonance, they would have had to start wondering, gee, what it means. But as I said, we have a microscopic theory, and if you write down, if you look at the equations correctly, the condition for the solution of getting superconductivity in a time-dependent fashion, looking at it, will give you the Higgs automatically, given that we have a microscopic theory. So in particle physics, what is this EPP? Elementary particle physics. Okay. I'm very confused. HEP, EP. It's of great importance. It completes a consistent phenomenological theory built on about 50 years of experiments and probably limits the form of any theory. Okay. Now, I must say, having spent a part of the last 2 or 3 years learning about the standard model, it is, I like to say, without any trace of irony, as beautiful and as intellectually satisfying as the best condensed matter physics. Okay, it really combines just 50 years of experiments into a set of simple rules making a consistent theory and has predictions. What more can one ask? Just for fun, let me show you just the detector of LHC. Here's a human being somewhere. And this is Alan Sakuto's lab, all of it, plus human beings. Okay, so you can detect it. Okay. Now, there are other ways of discovering Higgs. There's a recent experiment. So as I said, all you have to do is to shake the condensate. Okay. Now, you see, in condensed matter physics, it's very easy because we have superconductors and we have non-superconductors. So you can shake superconductors, okay, from outside. Okay, that's what we are doing. Now, think of doing it in elementary particle physics where everything is a condensate. Okay? But I want to come back to this point. The condensate, even for particle physics, cannot be uniform. Okay? So maybe there are some other experiments to be done yet. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. Okay? So I mentioned this cold boson experiment by Emmanuel Bloch. So incidentally, I should go back to this. Superfluid helium cannot have particle hole symmetry. Okay? I mean, there are these bosonic atoms whose individual components are the electrons bound to the protons with a binding energy of, 52 electron volt? Okay? So the first order equation of motion is correct, and you're never going to get Higgs or amplitude modes in helium. But these guys, they have these cold bosons, and there is a phase diagram of these cold bosons. Here's some dimensionless interaction parameter, and there's some filling. And there are some fillings. Because of the presence of the lattice, there is particle hole symmetry. And near this range, near particle hole symmetry and only around particle hole symmetry, they observe something which may be called the amplitude mode. I hesitate to call it the Higgs because in this problem, you cannot have a locally gauge invariant theory. They have global gauge invariants, but in cold atoms, you don't have local gauge invariants, so I would call it an amplitude mode. But they insist on calling it Higgs. Fine, good for them. And there is a similar problem with something you see. You see, what I'm describing is that whenever you have a two-component order parameter with an amplitude and a phase, there has to be a Higgs. Okay? And so there are lots of other or amplitude mode, and that's how you see. Okay. Now, finally, I should say, one of the things I have to say is that it is not quite true that one cannot couple to the Higgs. Okay, I realized this only recently through some conversations with Alan Goldman. How do you couple to a superconducting order parameter with an external probe? Only through another superconductor. Okay? So if you have a low-temperature superconductor, and you put it in contact with a higher temperature superconductor, the superconducting field of the high temperature superconductor will couple to the superconducting field of the low temperature superconductor and affect it. And now if you do some probes in the interface between them, you apply voltages or you apply magnetic field, you can shake that coupling. And so there is a chance, and Alan Goldman is doing that, trying to do that experiment. So Alan Goldman saw something called the Carlson-Goldman modes in the 1970s, and there were some high-frequency modes that he also saw, he said in the paper, but the theory said, no, that must be some funny noise in your data, and he did not ever publish any of the data, and he's now redoing these experiments. So there is an effect, okay? And that leads me to ask if there are such experiments in particle physics, okay, possible. You see, effectively, what I'm asking for is, do you have any physics of the kind of a Josephson effect in high energy physics in an experiment? Okay, and this poses in high energy physics all kinds of very interesting issues because they don't have a simple U1 theory. They have a non-abelian theory. Their bosons carry charge and whatnot. So, however, my statement is the following: supposing you have a nuclei and you don't have anything here, a vacuum. There's a condensate here, and there's a condensate in the nuclei. By the theory, the amplitude of the electroweak condensate in the nuclei is different from where there is no nuclei. Okay? And now, it really means that you should be able to now, by having two nucleons come close but not quite close and oscillate them with respect to each other. But what are we talking about? We are talking about distances on the scale of, or energies on the scale of now nuclear energies. It's not such a hard thing. You should be able to see Josephson type effects or proximity type effects in particle physics. That probably does not require an LHC. Okay? So that's, perhaps somebody will. Some people here know more about this than I do. So let me finally go to the kind of questions that appeared to me when I started reading about the Standard Model, and I'm just going to tell you the questions. My good friends in high-energy physics have told me some of the answers. So first question was, why is it so difficult for you to see the Higgs? Okay. In fact, it's 10 to the 10 and not 10 to the 9 right now. Okay. That's, if a condensed matter physicist thinks about this question, one learns a lot about relativistic kinematics, among other things. Okay, it's an amusing thing why the cross section is so small. Okay, it's, when you collide two protons, you're not at the speed with which they are colliding. They're not colliding two protons; they're colliding pancakes of quarks. Okay, the energy of each quark is much smaller. Okay. Here is an interesting question, which in superconductors, we heat the superconductor to some temperature, of the order of the superconducting gap, or the Higgs, and the condensate disappears. Okay? Shouldn't you be doing some experiments like that in high energy physics, asks the innocent condensed matter theorist? Okay? And this thing is not a nonsensical question. It is only about six orders of magnitude harder than what they are doing in Higgs, in LHC these days. Okay? I already told you what the penetration depth is, and the coherence length is simply the mass of the Higgs. Okay? Or the inverse coherence length squared is the mass of the Higgs from a condensed matter physics point of view. Okay, I already answered that they do have experiments which prove the existence of the electroweak condensate. This they love. Why can't you make a microscopic theory and derive the standard model from that? Okay? And finally, is it possible that the phenomenology is the theory? Will it become an axiom? And at this point, the string theorists say, no, no, no. We are going to, you know, there's got to be a foundation to that. Okay, and maybe there are other people who believe here differently. So with that, I'm going to quit.